Welcome, friends of wildlife, to Protect Our Wildlife's podcast, Untamed. I am Brenna Galdensi, and I am the president and co-founder of Protect Our Wildlife, Vermont's number one all-volunteer wildlife protection advocacy nonprofit. In this audio series, we will speak freely about many issues impacting wildlife in Vermont and how you can help. Today, we will be examining the following question. How can we discern when fish and wildlife departments use science and when they use value judgments to inform policy? Leading us in this conversation today is Dr. Adrienne Treves, professor and founder of the Carnivore Coexistence and lab professor of environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin. Adrienne conducts independent research and advocates for future generations and for scientific integrity. He studies and speaks about the public trust doctrine and intergenerational equity around the world. Adrienne earned his PhD at Harvard University in 1997. For the past 27 years, his research focuses on ecology, law, and human dimensions of ecosystems in which crop and livestock ownership overlaps the habitat of large carnivores, from coyotes up to grizzly bears. He has authored more than 133 scientific papers on predator-prey ecology or conservation. Welcome, Adrienne. You know how much I value your work, and I'm super excited to share your knowledge with our members and subscribers. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Brenna. It's an honor. I'm flattered to be invited.
So as Adrienne knows, and as many of you know, I've been working on wildlife protection efforts in Vermont since March or April of 2010. But really, prior to starting Protect Our Wildlife in February of 2015, I really had little idea for how wildlife management or wildlife policy was made in Vermont. And all of this kind of cropped up back in 2015 when a trapper petitioned the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department and Board seeking to extend the trapping seasons on river otters and bobcats, two of Vermont's most cherished species. And I participated in a lot of the public hearings and the discussions, and I quickly realized that Fish and Wildlife's support of extending the trapping seasons was not at all rooted in what each of us would expect to be sound science or a biological imperative to manage otter populations. It was based more in accommodating a trapper's request. But Fish and Wildlife's testimony was presented to the public and to decision makers as science. And that, to me, is very dangerous. And it opened my eyes, and it opened the eyes of a lot of our members and members of the public to how Fish and Wildlife operates. And it doesn't feel good, you know, not to be able to trust those in charge of making decisions on wildlife under the guise of wildlife management. I always say that fish and wildlife biologists can tell us how many otters or bobcats, you know, insert the wild animal of your choice, that can be trapped and killed without presenting major threats to their populations. But that science does not tell us that those animals should be trapped and killed in the first place. There really is no science, as far as I know, that tells us that river otters, for example, should be trapped and killed. So I think this really kind of tees up the conversation with Adrienne. And I guess the first question for Adrienne are, you know, what are the hallmarks of good science, in your opinion, in your years of delving into this challenge, Adrienne?
Well, thanks so much, Brenna. What you're describing is happening across the country, and in fact, across many countries where a lot of people and agencies are foremost in this. A lot of people and agencies or organizations would try to enfold their preferences in this appearance of science as if to justify what they prefer is somehow scientifically defensible. And I think one of the easiest ways to take off that cloak of science is to remember that science never tells us what to do. Science is about observing nature, taking measurements, and there's a system for that. But it doesn't tell us whether we ought to trap otters or hunt wildlife or not do that. Those are decisions based on ethical reasoning that stem from our values. So what we often find is that agencies try to conceal their personal or organizational value judgments about what to do by calling it supported by the best science or simply calling their decisions scientific. To give you an example of how widespread this is, I participated in a scientific team led by Dr. Kyle Artell, a Canadian researcher. He studied the management plans, actually 666 management plans across Canada and the USA that described hunting programs for wildlife. And he looked for the hallmarks of science in the text of those management plans, those hunt management plans. So we looked for the following hallmarks. We looked for transparency, which is a fancy word for openness, making everything clear about the methods and the conclusions drawn from the methods of observation and measurement. We looked for evidence of independent review. That's another hallmark of science. Independent review is the principle that when you have a method and you have some conclusions you've drawn from it, then you subject it to scrutiny by independent, by third parties who aren't involved. And the third hallmark I want to talk about today was objectivity in measurement, which is to say that the methods used for measurement and observation aren't being unduly distorted by those value judgments that are not scientific, but just stem from your personal values. And across those 666 North American hunt management plans, we found a depressingly low proportion missing some or all of those hallmarks. Very few hunt management plans had all three hallmarks, and the majority were lacking two or more of those hallmarks of science. So we concluded that North American wildlife decision-making is most often guided by something other than science, because so many decisions to hunt wildlife were not transparent or were not objective, objectively keeping away those personal value judgments, or did not undergo independent review. So what I would say about your anecdote about the otter policy was that the trapper was very clearly making a personal value judgment, right? They wanted to trap otters for a longer period, very clearly a personal value judgment. And the agency decided to cloak that in some semblance of science and conceal the fact that it's simply a desire by a certain set of individuals. And it's usually a really narrow minority of the public that want to kill wildlife, especially a very narrow minority that wants to trap animals like otters. And the agency was simply concealing that this was a very narrow minority exhibiting a personal value judgment. And the science really has nothing to do with whether we should or should not trap otters. I don't know. Does that help, Brenna? Does that answer the question?
It helps tremendously. And just to go over the hallmarks of science again, the three that you mentioned, it's independent review, objectivity, and transparency, correct?
Right. And the transparency extends to every step in the scientific process that starts with the researchers declaring any competing interests they have, any assumptions they're making, and then a very clear and open description of the methods they'll use, the analyses they'll run, and how they interpret those. So transparency also extends to independent review. So it's a cross-cutting principle that is probably the foundation of good science.
I'm not sure if I shared with you the poster that Protect Our Wildlife had created using the hallmarks of science, and we've shared it on social media. We've shared it with our members because it's so important for people to remember and to hold those responsible for making these important wildlife policy decisions, you know, hold them accountable to these hallmarks of science. And so thank you for sharing that. And, you know, that leads me to another question and something that is a big challenge and I think would really help with future discourse when Fish and Wildlife staff is providing testimony, let's say, to the legislature, or I just participated in a town select board meeting where town members wanted to ban trapping on town-owned lands. And the town select board invited the fur bearer biologist for the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department, viewing her kind of as an unbiased, you know, source of information. You know, she's a fur bearer biologist, right? And what I'm really imploring fish and wildlife agencies to start doing in the sake of transparency is to state those biases out of the gate. So before you start providing your position on trapping, whether you're going to support something or oppose something, it would be very helpful if fish and wildlife staff were to assert those biases. It would help for just more honest conversations and to help those who are kind of relying on fish and wildlife biologists for information and for opinion to understand that they are not free from bias. One thing that was really frustrating for wildlife advocates in Vermont is a couple of years ago, a student at the Vermont Law School presented a petition to the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department and the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Board seeking to institute a regulated coyote hunting season versus the current open killing season, which allows for, you know, coyote hunting 365 days of the year, night and day, leaving coyote pups orphaned. So her petition was not seeking to ban coyote hunting. It was just seeking for somewhat of a compromise, just a legal hunting season. And her petition had over 12,000 signatures. She gave a really good presentation. And Fish and Wildlife came in and they did their presentation. And of course, they showed a scary photo of a coyote with a cat in its mouth or something like that, fear-based narrative, and didn't really provide much science that supports the status quo, which is the open killing season on coyotes. And it's not the first time that Fish and Wildlife presented their position in a way that really was not at all based in sound science. They did it with the legislature back in 2018 when we banned coyote killing contests. The Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department did not at all support that legislation. So, I mean, Adrian, do you think it would be helpful if Fish and Wildlife staff would have to kind of come out and at least, I don't know how they would do it, but to have to say, you know, it is one of my job responsibilities or requirements as a fur bearer biologist to endorse trapping. So at least we have a starting point of understanding by those who are listening to better understand the biases. I don't know how they would accomplish that, but I think it's something that needs to be explored.
Oh, absolutely, Brenna. I mean, your two stories there show how transparency and objectivity are lacking in those public policy discussions. So let's start with the basically what you said, but we'll make it explicit. If the fur bearer biologist goes in front of a decision-making body or the public and says right up front, my salary is largely funded through hunting permits and hunting fees, and the leadership above me wants me to perpetuate that source of revenue, that would tear away this veneer, this pretense that these are unbiased public servants serving the entire broadest public and all interests. It would tear it away and leave what is honestly the truth in place, which is that the fur bearer biologist for the state is there to enhance the opportunity for that very small minority who want furs, who trap them for commercial benefit, which is completely a private interest. It's not a public interest, it's a private interest. Sometimes the agencies are aware that the veneer has been stripped away and that they're just protecting a private interest. And they try then to justify hunting, trapping, and hounding based on some perception that it's going to help society. The most common benefits to society claimed falsely by agencies are that killing these carnivores, these native carnivores like otters, coyotes, and wolves, that killing these animals are going to protect domestic animals like farm livestock or farm dogs, or it's going to protect human safety. And the scientific data simply don't support that claim. But let me step back away from the specifics and go back to your stories. I think if the fur bearer biologist were transparent right then and there about the sources of funding, that's called a competing interest in science. And they would no longer be viewed by the majority of the public as a trusted broker, a neutral source of information, because the source of their information is strongly biased by their competing interest. In some cases, it's a financial competing interest. Sometimes it's a non-financial one because they grew up in a system and have allegiance to groups like the Wildlife Society that are 100% dedicated to increasing hunting opportunities across the USA. So that mix of financial and non-financial competing interests is a strong bias. Scientists are people like everybody else. I have my own personal value judgments, which could bias my research. And the fact that we all have personal biases makes it essential that we expose them to public scrutiny, that we're transparent about them, and then we describe our methods. Because the fact that we have a bias doesn't mean our conclusions are wrong or biased, as long as the methods we've used for measurement and observation are the accepted methods done with full scientific integrity, that means full transparency and objectivity, and that we then subject our science to independent review so others who don't share our biases can make sure we've done it correctly. In that way, I've sort of inoculated my results from my personal biases. As long as I'm fully transparent, I share all the data, all the methods, all my analyses, then I've done due diligence as a scientist with integrity. The fur bearer biologist who goes there and asserts things like trapping is good has stepped over the line. They're interposing a personal or organizational value judgment in place of what they should do as public servants, which is inform the policymakers about the costs and the benefits of each decision and do so even-handedly and fairly. Without regard to where their own how their own salary is paid or where they get praise and flattery from interest groups. Currently, the U.S. system of wildlife governance needs drastic reform to eliminate those competing interests that make our public servants captured or slaves to interest groups like the trapping lobby, which is a tiny minority of people getting private benefits from what is a public asset for current and future generations.
I know you can't see me, but I am over here clapping because so much of what you're saying, I think, you know, the more that the public understands this, I really think that we as a wildlife advocacy community need to start challenging and requesting that there's more transparency out of the gate whenever there's a discussion coming up, especially again, when fish and wildlife agencies are presenting to the general public, if they're presenting to the legislature, you know, yes, they are biologists. Yes, they probably know a lot about bobcats and otters and all these other animals under their jurisdiction. But coming out of the gate, like you said, Adrian, and just, you know, asserting that their role as being a fish and wildlife staff is to those three R's, right? Recruit, retain, reactivate new hunters, trappers, and anglers. I think that's part of Fish and Wildlife's task nationwide. It's not specific to the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. So I think that would really help the public and those who are kind of relying on Fish and Wildlife just to kind of better understand things from larger picture and how some of their decisions are being made. And I know I reached out to you a couple of months ago, maybe it was longer than that, regarding Vermont's moose hunt. And we did a lot of independent research here in examining Vermont Fish and Wildlife's position of we must kill moose to kill ticks. And whenever they presented to the public on their position of the moose hunt in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont here, they never mentioned who helps fund this research, right? I mean, the Safari Club International, they funded Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department's moose study to the tune of over $120,000. And that's a decent amount of money. And we know that the Safari Club International, they promote trophy moose hunting. And when your research is kind of tainted by outside donations that have a certain mindset and a certain desired end result, you know, at least, again, coming out and just sharing that with the public so that people understand. I mean, we only found out about it through public records requests that we submitted to the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department when we really started scratching our heads. But, you know, again, their research there's no requirement at the end of the day for them to be able to prove to the public that their science worked. So yeah, well, now Vermont's moose have less ticks, and Vermont's moose have less ticks because we killed more moose. I mean, so they put forth this theory about, you know, getting moose down to a certain density. And again, less moose on the landscape means less spread of ticks. But I mean, how does the public ever know if this hypothesis, is that what you would call it, or a theory actually worked? I mean, will they be able to say to us 5 years from now that, oh yeah, Vermont's moose hunt worked, it actually achieved what they set out to do? I don't think we'll ever know. And that to me is a really big problem, because we know that Vermont's moose herd is suffering tremendously. And the only reason they offered this moose hunt, again, they were claiming, is to reduce the spread of ticks. And a lot of the research that we did pretty much informed us that, okay, sure, maybe killing 60 moose in 2020 isn't going to decimate the moose herd, but we can't imagine that it's going to save the moose herd either. And all of these suspicions stem from comments that we hear from Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Like one of the board members a couple of years ago when this was being discussed said, oh, well, if we put a moratorium on moose hunting in Vermont, then it's going to be that much harder to start it back up again in the future. So, you know, when we hear things like that, you can't help but say to yourself, wow, well, is Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department still having this moose hunt because they want to keep the moose hunt going, you know, and they're having a very limited hunt? Again, not to make moose healthier, but just to ensure that the hunt continues. Again, a small all-volunteer nonprofit like ours, we did a lot of work doing a deep dive into this. And what we found wasn't at all, it didn't make us feel good. So, and Protect Our Wildlife isn't the only organization that is dealing with these types of things. I mean, I know there's organizations across the country like ours, you know, who are doing similar work. I mean, Adrian, do you have any advice for advocacy organizations like Protect Our Wildlife to align ourselves with the best available science? Because Fish and Wildlife agencies, they have partnerships with so many different universities, and a lot of other NGOs are afraid to speak out against Fish and Wildlife science. It's almost like a gag order on any kind of opposing opinions. So how do we get that? You know, how do we get someone to help kind of do a deep dive in an unbiased fashion?
Yeah, I hear your frustration, Brenna. There is a chokehold on decision-making in wildlife. It's being done by a very small number of people whose values don't align with the values of the broader U.S. public, and definitely not with youth and future generations, as far as our scientific surveys can show, because so few people hunt and so few people value lethal management. It's just a few traditionalists who are holding out for these methods that most of the U.S. society views as repugnant and unnecessary. And I got to say, the logic you're outlining for the moose hunt in Vermont strikes me as much the same logic used to justify killing wolves. Oh, yeah, we'll kill wolves to help the other surviving wolves. And basically, that logic is so hard to believe. I just can't believe agencies are still saying it. The various reasons given for killing animals to protect the survivors in the same population are generally that it's going to increase tolerance by people for that wildlife, or that by killing a few troublemakers of the wildlife species, you're going to prevent poaching and policy changes that would eradicate the wildlife population. That's probably not what they're arguing with the moose and the ticks, but it's just very hard to believe that killing a few moose is going to protect the many surviving moose. So my suggestion is that your listeners who feel outraged by this have to make the calls to their lawmakers. They have to keep calling month after month. You've got to show up at the Wildlife Commission meetings until Wildlife Commissions are abolished as undemocratic, unrepresentative, and unfair, and replace them with a more democratic process. And people have to show up at the ballots and vote on environmental and wildlife issues. So aside from that, the other tools, the other branches of a democratic government are important too, right? The courts have to hold agencies to the standard of best available science for their policies. And for that to happen, this is a battle on many fronts. Scientists have to work with legal scholars and lawyers and courts to educate the legal system about what is the best available science. Because there's anecdotes out there, like the ticks on the moose. That's just an anecdote until it's actually tested with the transparent, objective science that's subjected to independent review. Until that's done, it's not scientific at all. But then there's good and there's bad science. And we need to become educated consumers about the difference. And that starts with understanding transparency. If you see a scientific study put in front of you, the original scientific study in a peer-reviewed journal, but the data aren't shared openly and transparently, well, that's not as good science as the science that's put in front of you and all the data are there, openly presented, so you could reanalyze them yourself. It's simple principles of open science. That's what it's being called now, capital O, open science. Those simple principles of transparency that are allowing many fields of science to overcome what's called a reproducibility crisis. The reproducibility crisis, in a word, is the finding that actually a lot of published studies are not accurate or precise or reliable. That when people have tried, when scientists have tried to replicate those studies identically using the methods, they've been unable to find the same results. That reproducibility crisis has triggered reactions in the fields of biomedicine and psychology and other fields to improve the practice of science so that it's reliable for public policy. Wildlife is way behind the curve on this. Most articles in wildlife science do not share data openly, and they leave out a lot of methods. We've published this, we've exposed it, and as a result, my colleagues and I have been blacklisted by some wildlife agencies. They want to keep it all concealed. They want to keep it hidden. They don't want their science subjected to independent review, let alone all these criteria of transparency, objectivity, and independent review. And that's why so many agencies' so-called data are not actually published in peer-reviewed journals, because the journals, one by one, are waking up to the bogus science that's being peddled by agencies and the captive scientists that they pay through cooperative extension arrangements, because the wildlife agencies have the grants for research. And I just want to end commenting on your phrase that science can be tainted by funding. That's true, but science does need outside funding to make progress. Good science and bad science both have funding. So it's not so much the source of the funding that's the problem. It's when the scientists conducting that research are not transparent, don't disclose their sources of funding, or they're not completely transparent about their methods and going through that independent review, which most proper scientific journals do. And let me just leave you with one more slightly nerdy fact about science that I think the public isn't aware of. There's a very simple third-party metric of how strong a scientific journal is. And from that, you can guess how strong a scientific article is. If it's published in that journal, look at the journal's impact factor. These are kept worldwide by a third party that analyzes the quality and the reach of a scientific journal. And some scientific journals that agencies publish in don't even have an impact factor. The ones most commonly cited for wildlife, the Journal of Wildlife Management, has a very low impact factor. So look at the impact factor of journals, and you can do an initial screening of scientific studies based on quality from the impact factors of the journals in which they're published. I don't think the public realizes this. It's not a perfect system. They're still quibbling about impact factors, but it's a pretty good system for coarse discrimination between different kinds of scientific studies. And if the agency is peddling science that's not even in a journal, it's no better than anecdote.
That's a really, really helpful tip, and one that I will be employing for sure.
Thanks, Brenna. I appreciate that.
For sure. And I think back to what we were talking about before, for fish and wildlife agencies, it's about offering opportunities, increasing opportunities, right? So again, let's take bobcat hunting or bobcat trapping. Our own fur bearer biologist here in Vermont has gone on record when she was interviewed by a reporter saying that, well, bobcats, you know, unlike some other species, don't really need to be managed. If their populations are doing okay, it's a recreational sporting or hunting or trapping activity that's offered to the public. And they don't say that a lot, but that was disclosed in an interview that was given a couple of years ago. And I remembered that. And I think we need to hear more of that. Not that that's what we want, but that's a more honest depiction of what these state fish and wildlife departments are doing. They're looking to seek to increase hunting, hounding, trapping opportunities. And as long as the animals' populations are considered viable, they are going to look to offer those opportunities and in some cases extend them. One thing you mentioned that really resonated was when you said killing increases the tolerance of species. We hear that over and over and over again. We mostly hear it in Vermont as it relates to beavers. We also hear it as it relates to coyotes. And I have to say, I think that it's the exact opposite. I think when you have such liberal killing seasons like you do for coyotes and for beavers, I think the public kind of looks at these animals like, oh, well, they must not really be that worth that much in our landscapes. I mean, there's an open season on coyotes and Vermont Fish and Wildlife says it's okay. So coyotes must not be that important. These are comments we've actually received from coyote hunters and predator haters on our social media page that, you know, oh, well, if coyotes were that important to the ecosystem or if beavers are that important, Fish and Wildlife wouldn't allow so many to be killed. So I think that killing increases tolerance of species. I disagree. I think in some cases with certain species, it's just the opposite. I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, well, I think your hunch is supported by the best available science. When it comes to wolves, I can speak most directly to the science about tolerance for wolves. We've studied this in the same individual humans over time, people living in and outside of wolf range. We've sampled them repeatedly over 13 years in Wisconsin. And we found that tolerance for wolves declined, especially when the government liberalized wolf killing. So to put it another way, the killing the state allowed of wolves did not increase tolerance for wolves. It decreased tolerance for wolves. It led to more calls for killing. It led to the crazy policies seen in the state of Wisconsin this past February 2021. And in general, I think you're on the right track that the agency sends a very strong signal about the value of particular wildlife species in the way it communicates about them, in the permit fees it sets, in the penalties it exacts for people who kill these animals illegally. And those policies are representations of value judgments by individuals or by the organization that predators don't have much value. And the only thing that has value are these so-called trophy game species. Those are euphemisms for the animals they like versus the animals they don't like. And we just need to strip away all that jargon. Even increasing hunting opportunities is a euphemism for increasing killing with permit fees gained by the agency for that killing. We need to strip away those euphemisms and boil this down to differences between in values between different groups and stop letting a narrow interest group that wants to hunt, trap, and hound and eliminate predators, stop them from dictating wildlife policy and let the broad U.S. public or the state population decide these policies. So I guess the way I would end this rant, my little rant here, is to suggest that when the state agency is very transparent that they're simply opening up a recreational hunting opportunity, that's probably good. They're not trying to justify the killing, that it has any social benefit other than the very narrow benefit to one or two individuals who want to do that recreational activity. And when it's framed in that way, it's easier for activists like yourself to point out what a tiny minority they're catering to. And what about the needs and desires of the broader population and youth who don't get to vote and who don't have much say about the appointment of agency leadership? That's when the activist community has to step up and say, recreation, that involves killing is probably morally repugnant and is anyway a tiny minority of how people want to recreate. And if it's going to infringe on recreational activities that don't harm nature, like hiking, camping, boating, et cetera, that's when policymakers need to ask, do we even need trapping? What if somebody's dog gets harmed? What if an endangered species gets harmed by trapping otters? Why are we allowing this narrow fringe activity by a few people seeking a profit from furs to affect the enjoyment of nature by the rest of the Vermont public or any state's public?
Precisely. And one last thing, but I think it's important because we're talking about the tolerance of species. I want to just touch upon quickly the terms cultural carrying capacity. We hear that a lot. And I want to just briefly bring this up about as it relates to bears in Vermont. So again, Vermont Fish and Wildlife's management of black bears is done more from, they claim, a cultural carrying capacity versus a biological carrying capacity. And just so our listeners know, the cultural carrying capacity is the amount of wildlife, in this case, bears, that the public wants around. And the biological carrying capacity is the presumed, is that the right word? capacity of the land. You know, how much land that animal needs and do we have that land to accommodate? But in Vermont, a survey was done, I don't know when it was, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. It was conducted by the Fish and Wildlife Department and it was on black bears. And the results of that survey showed that most Vermonters or more Vermonters wanted an increase in black bears versus a decrease in black bears. And I think it was about 57% of the population of Vermonters wanted the bear population to remain the same. Very few wanted the bear population to be reduced. So if we're managing bears on a cultural carrying capacity, I guess we're confused as to why Fish and Wildlife still has been allowing record high kills. In 2021, we had 20% of the bear population killed off. Our bear season is extremely long, including the use of hounds. So again, you know, using cultural carrying capacity, okay, great. But then when they get survey results that don't kind of mesh with their agenda, they don't even follow their own philosophy. Do I get what I'm saying, Adrian?
I hear your frustration. By the way, there's really no science behind the idea of cultural carrying capacity. And then when they ignore it, you know, it's just pure power politics. They're just doing what they want because no one's stopping them.
It's just another real great term to throw out there that sounds like it means something, right. And it really doesn't. And they apply it when it works, and when it doesn't work, they don't apply it. So that really is a head scratcher for me. And I guess I just want to close this podcast just by kind of imparting on our listeners that we don't want to have this culture of distrust in those who are in charge of making decisions on this shared public, what's called resource. We call it a shared public asset. We want to be able to trust decision makers because we all care about wildlife. And talking with you, Adrian, I think we'll give our listeners some starting points as to what they can do, either showing up at public hearings or Fish and Wildlife Board meetings or in the legislature. You know, a lot of good tips for people to take action. I also want to just, again, mention the tremendous work that you're doing out west with wolves. And if there's anything that you want to share with our listeners, I know you had mentioned a paper that you had written about wolves that I read that was a real eye-opener for me. Is there some place where our listeners can go to kind of read some of your papers, or if they want to contribute to the Carnivore Coexistence Lab, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, my lab has a website where all of our papers are free. They can be downloaded. And for the people who don't have the time to read a scientific paper, all the abstracts are right there online. So you can read those in a matter of minutes. It's the Carnivore Coexistence Lab at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, University of Wisconsin-Madison. And my last name is spelled T-R-E-V-E-S. If you Google me, you'll see me. And I would just end by encouraging people to get involved, demand that agencies are transparent and that they subject their so-called science to independent review. Because I think without the public pressure, they're going to continue doing what they have been doing, which is a kind of pulling the wool over the public's eyes and catering to a very narrow minority interest group that pays hunting fees, hunting, trapping, and hounding fees. And that's not the democratic principle that the U.S. is founded on. Our constitutional principles of equal protection for all our citizens are being stepped on basically every day. And we have to stand up for our rights, stand up for our constitution every day. It's never over, the fight for democracy. And Brenda, the work you're doing here with this program is super important because I can only reach so many people with my science and public talking. So thank you very much for hosting me.
Yes, and we will include your website link on our communications along with a link for people to contribute to your work. You make the work of small nonprofits like mine all the more possible. So cheers to maybe another podcast with you in the future, Adrian.
Thank you, Brenna.
And thank you again.
Cheers. Thank you. Take care.